So, if you don't know yet, this is a theme day on hospitality. One definition that I read recently described hospitality as welcoming people into your homes who don't regularly belong there. And this is an interesting, I sort of like that in some ways. It sounds like a good start to me, but it's not a complete definition, is it? Because you could do this in a technical sense and still miss the heart of what hospitality is. So I'd like to just mention from the outset a few things that I think are essential ingredients to hospitality. These are not comprehensive. This doesn't sum up hospitality, but essential ingredients that get at what hospitality is as a way of life, not just as a technical opening your door, feeding somebody. And I think that these things will sort of come up in the course of the lecture and maybe the whole day. So the first sort of essential ingredient is making room in your home for the outsider, whether that's a stranger or a friend. I was reading one theologian who was talking about how hospitality provides one of the few links between the public life and the private life, the public sphere and the private sphere. If you think of all of the people you interact with throughout the day, when you're at work, if you're doing business, if you are commuting, if you're buying groceries, the majority of the people you interact with are strangers. And then you go home, which is this private space. And it's not very often that those two things are gapped, that there's a bridge between the two, the private sphere and the public sphere. And one of the ways in which it is that bridge is gapped, is hospitality. When you actually invite someone who you do not know or don't know well into your space. So making room for the outsider, that's just an essential thing. And then honoring the outsider by offering a space where they can be themselves, which communicates that they're valuable. Allowing a space where someone can actually be themselves. I think we've all experienced when that hasn't been given to us, when we're expected to be something we're not, and we're expected to be more interesting than we are, or we're expected to be really interested in what the host is interested in. But true hospitality is space for someone to actually be who they are. And then, this is from the perspective of someone who is a host, offering something genuine of yourself to them. It's not just about offering physical space or another place setting at the table. True hospitality is letting someone into your real life and offering a degree of vulnerability. I don't think absolute, complete vulnerability necessarily, but something honest and without pretense. And this is actually maybe one of the distinctions. I'm not sure if Marty talked about this last night, but one of the distinctions between hospitality and entertaining, right? Entertaining involves some aspect of, not that it's a bad thing to throw a party, but some aspect of performance, putting on something glitzy and shiny that isn't necessarily a reflection of your daily life. It may be very different from your daily life. So, essentially, what we have in these three things is a space in which both the host and the guest are authentically themselves, but which there's been room made for the outsider. And there are many, many biblical passages that mention the importance of hospitality. And Marty talked about a lot of them last night. In 1 Timothy and the book of Titus, both mention hospitality as a requirement for leadership in the church. And then there are other places where it mentions hospitality as a mandate for all Christians, no matter who you are, whether you're in leadership or not. These are passages like Ephesians 4, Hebrews 13, 1 Peter chapter 4, among other places. So in other words, a mandate for all Christians means all of you should be offering hospitality. It should be the distinguishing mark of the church. Christians should consider it a normal part of life. Challenging, yes, but ordinary part of life. And that is a challenge because the fact that hospitality today appears to us to be such a radical thing actually should tell us something about us, right? It's supposed to be an ordinary thing that Christians do, and yet it appears in today's world to be a radical, countercultural decision, right? But I think one of the ways we can start to think about it is how are ways in which we can make it ordinary to us again? We can view it as an ordinary thing. My immediate question, though, is if this is a mandate to all Christians, I want to say, my immediate question is, really? Can it be that all Christians are called to a practice that clearly some are gifted at more than others? Right? What is the Bible really getting us into here? What about the introverts among us? What about the painfully shy and the socially awkward Christians? What about those who can't cook? So Mary Frances is going to do a lecture later on today saying, you know, but I can't cook. So what are some of the practical obstacles to offering hospitality? What if you don't feel like you have the set of gifts that would be necessary to offer it? What about those of us who don't feel we have adequate space or physical space or time margins to offer anything to anybody at all? That's one of the other challenges that we face today, just the time in our lives to do it. So one way forward, I think, which we'll be talking about throughout the day, is to explore more realistic ways of offering hospitality. Can we have less elevated expectations of what it is and make the whole endeavor more accessible and less intimidating? How can we help ourselves to view it as an ordinary way of life rather than some massive production? And I think our other speakers throughout the day will be dealing with this more than me. This morning I want to do something a little bit different. I'm going to attempt to defend those crazy New Testament passages that say hospitality is a practice for all Christians. And I want to give some background theology for why these claims are actually reasonable and why they should make sense to us. And so this is kind of a stepping back and providing a little bit of sort of a foundation to move forward on. Is the New Testament making an unreasonable claim on Christians by saying that all of you are called to this, or is it a reasonable claim? Basically, I think that the mandate of hospitality rests on two very broad foundations, and there may be more. These are the two that occurred to me. The first foundation is we're all made to do it. It's how we were created. We're all made in the image of God, and it's in the image of God who is the great host. So offering hospitality is one of the ways in which we reflect His image. Hospitable is what God is, and we as Christians are called to godliness. And so we are called to hospitality. There's a connection there between how we were made and what we're called to. Secondly, anyone who is a Christian has been a recipient of God's hospitality. It's a gift that is more glorious, more extravagant than most of us can ever comprehend. And we certainly can't pay for it. So in light of this, when we consider the strangers outside our doors, we're supposed to remember that we too were outsiders who are now children of God through no virtue of our own. And then we're called to receive others as we ourselves have been received. And so that's the sort of second foundation of hospitality. First, you have the fact that we were made in the image of God who is hospitable. And second of all, we have been shown great hospitality. We have received it. A wonderful biblical example of the latter, that we've been shown hospitality, is early on in the Bible. This is not just a New Testament concept, by the way. This is throughout. But in Leviticus, which gets a bad rap in many of our lives, there's some wonderful things in Leviticus. This is a beautiful thing in Leviticus. Leviticus 19, verse 33, "When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native-born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God." Isn't that great? It's beautiful and unambiguous. And really what this is supposed to call to mind in the minds of Israelites was the beginning of the Decalogue, the beginning of the Ten Commandments, which begin, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt," right? This is the beginning of the Ten Commandments. All the stipulations that have to do with the followers' behavior follow from, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt." So the gift of God comes first. All the things we're supposed to do are a response to the gift of God and a way of essentially staying free I've made you free, now here's how you stay free. But anyway, I think an early Israelite would have heard that in the, I am the Lord your God. You were foreigners in Egypt, but I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. So in other words, not to be too repetitive, sorry, we're made to open our doors and our hearts to strangers because we were strangers and God opened the door to us. So we're going to be looking at the Bible a lot. Every biblical example that we'll be looking at, I think, will be emphasizing one or the other or both of these two foundations. We're made in the image of God who's hospitable, and we've been shown hospitality. And so here is the basic outline for today. What does imaging God mean in a very broad sense? What does that even look like? What does it mean? And then secondly, how is God hospitable to us through the story of creation, fall, and redemption? So looking at the very big kind of chapter headings of the Christian story. So what does imaging God mean? When we talk about the image of God, I think there's two ways in which we use that word image. We use it as a noun and we use it as a verb. When we say every human being has been made in the image of God, or when we say we are all image bearers of God, we're using it as a noun, right? It's an unchangeable theological fact. We are the image of God. Human beings are the image of God. It's a designation that we have that has been given to us from beyond ourselves. That's the noun use. And there's many, many implications of this. But I'll just name a few here. First of all, to be human is a very, very good thing. In God's original creation, there was nothing wrong with being a human being. It's important to remember that. And even now, our humanity is not something that we need to be redeemed from. We do need to be redeemed so that our full humanity can be restored. Humanity is good. We have fallen short of our humanity, and it needs to be redeemed. So we're not at war with humanity here. Humanity is an amazing, amazing, glorious, and high calling. Secondly, this is again speaking about the word image in the noun form. If you are made in the image of God, this is true of you whatever your capacities are. If we're talking about a noun here. It's something we have by virtue of being human. It's not something that we manufacture. Whether you are old or young, whether you're rich or poor, kind or mean-spirited, regardless of how intelligent or physically capable you are, or how able you are to contribute to society, whether or not you're a Christian, you bear the image of God, and it's not something we bear to varying degrees. Depending on who we are and what we're like and what our gifts are, we just have it. Period. And I think you see this. It's sort of an interesting thing we see. It's easy to overlook, I think, but in Genesis 1:26, the image of God is something that God decides to bestow on Adam and Eve before He's even made them. He is not evaluating their capacities and then saying, oh, they look like me. He says, I'm going to make people in my image. And He's obviously not evaluating their capacities because they don't exist yet. He's decided to create a being that is like Him, and He sets out to do it. So it's clearly something that's given from Him. It's not something that we perform and then He evaluates, right? Another way of saying this is that the image of God gives humans intrinsic value. This is the second little heading here. Intrinsic value, as opposed to extrinsic value. Intrinsic value means it's something that is in you. It's part of what you are. It's built into what it is to be a human being. And this fact alone, I think, is enough for us to say that another person, no matter who they are, has dignity and is worthy of our hospitality. There's all kinds of practical caveats that we can make about that statement, that another human being is worthy of our hospitality by virtue of them being in the image of God. There's all kinds of practical decisions that we have to make when we have people into our homes. I'm not trying to deny that. But in a general sense, another human being is worthy of being shown hospitality by us because they are in the image of God. Not because they're nice or kind necessarily or moral or deserving of love or lovable, or not because they have anything in common with us necessarily at all. But simply because every person is in the image of God, everyone has dignity, even the ones that we view as being undignified. Dignity comes from God. There are many lost and lonely images of God wandering in the world. So images of God who feel like strangers everywhere they go. We have been there too, many of us. So if we open our doors to another person, we are opening our doors to an image of the Lord. And this is what I mean when I talk about the image of God as used as a noun. The image, this intrinsic thing that you have if you're a human being. But there's another way of using the word image, and that is as a verb. When we say we are called to image our Creator, the Christian images God, we're talking about it as a verb, essentially. We're using it as a verb. Whether or not that's a grammatically correct thing to do, it's an appropriate thing to do theologically, I think, in some ways. And I want to explain that without at all contradicting what I've just said about it being a designation. There's a way in which we're supposed to strive towards imaging God better. And this, because the image of God is something we all bear as a noun, but it has been marred by the fall and by our sin. So it's as if it's a portrait that's been sort of scribbled on and torn and painted over. The portrait still exists, and we can't deny that it exists, but it's been obscured and distorted. So imaging God in our lives is like a restoration project of the portrait. It's a work of the Holy Spirit in the Christian, but it also involves our agency and intention. It's another way of referring to the whole task of sanctification, which is the work of God in us, drawing us towards Christ-likeness. And it's a task that only God will himself complete in us. This is a bit of a tension, but something that I think we need to kind of hold together. We are in the image of God right now, noun, and we are called to image him, verb. And the reason I'm mentioning this from the outset is that offering hospitality, which is something we can choose to do or not do, is one of the ways in which we actively image our Creator. It's one of the ways that we actively can resemble our Creator. Obviously in a very small and derivative way, but it's one of the ways we resemble the one who made us. So we're going to move on to the next main section here. How is God hospitable? How does being in the image of God compel us to offer hospitality? If it does, we need to make the case that God himself really is hospitable, first. That the whole concept originates in his character. That's something we need to be convinced of. And only then can we say that we're called to be like God in his hospitality, right? He has to have hospitality for us to be like him in that. So we'll be looking at Scripture with hospitality in mind, sort of through the lenses of hospitality and seeing what we find. And this is a very, very wide-angle lens kind of shot of Scripture. There's a lot that I'm leaving out. I may leave out some of your favorite parts of the Bible. But I don't want to be here all day. There's lots of other things that need to happen today. So creation. So we're starting in the very beginning. Nikki, my wife, and I had a wonderful professor in grad school named Ian Proven, who's an Old Testament professor. And he said something in the foundation class, Introduction to the Old Testament, a very, very basic and simple thing, but the way he said it just somehow stuck in my head. I think probably because, even though it's a very simple thing to say, it is easy to forget in the language of the church sometimes. And that is, the physical world is God's place. Right, we think of it as very often being there's this physical world which is just full of disease and torment and sin and self-deception and all the results of the fall, and then there's heaven, right? And there is a distinction there, right? Heaven is where God's will is done actually perfectly. Earth is the place where God's will is not done perfectly, as it is in heaven, as the Lord's Prayer says. But the physical world is God's place, and we see this in Psalm 24, among obviously other places, but he's not abandoned it and he sustains it in every moment. Psalm 24 says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it, for he founded it on the seas and established it on the waters." This is Psalm 24, written after the fall. and yet claiming that this is still God's place. It's His. The whole universe is unambiguously His. The fact that He made it gives Him a total and legitimate claim to ownership. It's His place. And obviously the first chapters of Genesis, the first chapter of Genesis, and chapter 2 as well, presents God's culminating act as the creation of human beings. This is the sixth day of creation in Genesis 1. All the other days seem to build to this moment where the image bearers, human beings, are placed in the world. And Joshua, our colleague, did an awesome lecture the last term, a little while ago, on creation as the temple, this image, the temple imagery in Genesis 1. And I think this is what one of the things that Genesis 1 is trying to call to mind, and as well as Genesis 2. But that there's this massive space that God has created, and the culmination of that is sort of the dedication of creation, is to place the image in the world, which is analogous to placing a statue of a deity in a temple, which would have been a language that ancient people would have been very, very familiar with. But day six, in any case, is the culmination of God's creation, and it's when He makes people. But it's interesting to note how the other days build up to day six. Many scholars have pointed out that there's two different kinds of creating that God is doing here. He's creating space on the one hand, and then He's filling it with things on the other hand. On days one through three, God is creating space. Specifically, He's opening up habitable space. God brings order out of the watery chaos, what was earlier a formless and empty void, what it says in the very, very beginning. A formless and empty void, and God brings order out of that. He begins to create distinctions where there were no distinctions. He draws boundary lines where there were none. He creates form where there was formlessness. And so day one is the distinction between light and darkness, and day and night. That's a distinction. There will be light, there will be darkness. Day two is the creation of the sky, containing the waters above and separating them from the waters below. Day three is all about distinguishing the land from the sea and telling the water basically to stay put over there and the land to emerge as dry. An important distinction. And only then does He start to actually fill the space He has opened up. He starts with plants on day three, fish in the sea on day five, land animals, and finally human beings on day six. And so what's going on here? I think God is preparing a place for living things, and specifically for humans, to live. Without this preparation and ordering and drawing of boundaries, creation is uninhabitable. No life is possible. And this is still true. It's a good thing to reflect on. The amount of order and consistency that is necessary for any living organism to exist is tremendous. This is why we haven't found a lot of aliens yet in the universe. The stability that is provided for us on Earth by physical laws behaving consistently, again and again and again, because they're sustained by God, is the only reason that anyone can live. So this is not a small thing. It's an easy thing to take for granted because it just happens the same way over and over again. But is it a small thing? No. And this is just an aside. This is, I think, there was a past student and helper who was with us for a while who pointed this out to me, and I'm sort of fleshing out a bit more. But people at Labrie, if they're around for a long time, they're given all kinds of tasks, and one of them is to sort of clean the house and do various things, tidying up and helping to make the house look good again. What I've just said about creating space in creation is the theological basis for why cleaning and tidying our homes is a rich spiritual discipline. It's not something that we think about very often as being a rich spiritual discipline. It's more of a nuisance. But in our tiny and very derivative way, we are bringing order out of chaos and creating habitable space into which we can welcome others. This is where we're going. Obviously, it becomes a healthier place for us, but it enables us to actually open that space to other people. I think a measure of order is actually necessary for hospitality to work. Not obsessive and perfect order, not sort of tyrannical cleanliness necessarily, but enough order so that a stranger can actually walk into your home and know that they're wanted and feel safe, right? So chaos is not a friend of hospitality. Talk about that later. Someone else will answer that, you know, all your questions about that later on. So God prepares a place in which humans can survive and thrive. It's abundant with food, a place where they can be naked and safe, naked and unashamed. There's no concept of shame yet. And all of this in His presence. God's presence is a safe place for human beings to be in the beginning. And God actually allows people a measure of real freedom. This is what I mean by dominion here. This is a theological term, but dominion meaning a degree of agency in the world. We can do things. We can affect the world around us. We're not just puppets. So a measure of real freedom, but it's a measure of real freedom given to human beings within God's space. They're put in the garden, God's garden, to tend it. In other words, to continue the ordering that He Himself has started and to care for it in the way that He cares for it. And this is the biblical concept of stewardship. We don't own the world around us. It's God's, but we're put in it and told to care for it and to use it wisely and to tend it. God even allows Adam to name the animals. This is something that is really quite profound. I think Adam's will, his creativity, his individuality are actually encouraged by God in God's space. So Genesis 2:19, I've highlighted the parts that I think are particularly crazy. Now the Lord God has formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky, and He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. And so the parts that I've highlighted are actually quite... it's amazing what is not said. It doesn't say God led the animals before Adam to tell him what they were called. It doesn't even say God led the animals before Adam knowing what they would be called, but allowing Adam the illusion of having a choice. He led them before Adam to see what this man would call them. That's a striking thing. And whatever the man called them, that was its name. It's not like, okay, you can pretend that's what it's called, and I know what they're really called. It's that was its name. He gives Adam this incredible sort of authority to name the things in creation that are below him as an image bearer of God. So Adam and Eve are in God's space. They're allowed to truly engage with it as themselves. So to sum this section up, the whole physical universe is God's place. And in relationship to Him, every living thing is a guest. All creation enjoys God's hospitality. And I think we see that human beings are His special guests. Totally dependent on Him, yet in His image and respected as other. And if this isn't proof enough of God's hospitality in creation, He gives this invitation. I think it's not always called an invitation, but... it's called the cultural mandate, but that is the blessing: be fruitful and multiply, and everything that follows, having to do with subduing the earth, ruling over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air. This incredible actual blessing that God gives them: be fruitful and multiply. But you can read it also as an invitation. The world is mine, says God, but come on in and make yourself at home. Explore it, discover things, exert your dominion. There's a place here for you to flourish. So that's the good beginning, right? Of course, the fall occurs, recounted in Genesis 3. The communion that existed in creation did not last. In Genesis 3, humans could grasp at God's authority to determine right from wrong, which is really grasping at godlike status themselves. And in doing this, Adam and Eve reject His rule. They are saying, we do not need you, you are not our king. This is a disastrous rejection, not just of God's authority, but actually of God's hospitality too. It's a rejection of God's hospitality. It's as if they're saying, what you have provided is not enough. We want your world on our terms, right? They're trying to bust out of their role as guests, in a sense. As if God had no right to withhold anything at all from them. Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden, which on the surface doesn't sound very hospitable from God. What has happened to God's hospitality after the fall? Is it gone? How do we think about it? We clearly have to re-envision it somehow. The world is still God's. It didn't stop being His place. He didn't just leave and say, I'm done with this place. People are still His guests in the world, but after the fall, I think creation becomes much less hospitable to people. This is the description of the curse in Genesis 3. It's still habitable, but it's hard to live in. Really hard to live in. Work, which was initially a good and glorious thing, to tend the garden, this is something that happened before the fall, work becomes toil. To eat involves a battle with the weeds and the thistles and the woodchucks, in my case, and everything else. To eat becomes a battle. The human relationship with the rest of creation becomes strained and marked with struggle, danger, and anxiety. There's a scholar named Sandy Richter that we have listened to a lot of her teaching over the years. She has a friend, a scholar of ancient Near Eastern languages, and this friend claimed that claims that the language it talks about by the sweat of your brow is not just talking about hard work, like you'll have to work hard now to eat. That is an ancient expression for anxiety. Anxiety about your needs being met will be a part of your everyday life now, in a way in which it was not before. The sweat of your brow. We sweat on our brows when we're anxious and scared. So, again, I can't confirm that. I'm not a scholar of ancient Syriac or whatever it was, but it's a really important thing to think about. So creation is much less hospitable. Death enters the world. There's also a barrier now between people and God as a result of sin. So God's holy presence is not a safe place now that human beings are sinful. And I think this is, in a sense, the real tragedy of Genesis 3. The loss of the presence of God. They cannot gaze on the face of their Maker anymore. They cannot experience the joy of safely standing in His presence. So there's an aspect of communion with God which is lost at the fall. It's important to note, though, that even in His expulsion of Adam and Eve, God is still merciful. He clothes them, which is a hospitable act. He guards them from the terrible fate of eating from the tree of life. That's one of the things that their expulsion accomplishes. They will not eat from the tree of life now, because if they did, they would live forever in a state of alienation from their Maker. And so he also makes this mysterious pledge that one day the head of the enemy will be crushed. And all that being said, the great host has become a more distant host now. His presence is no longer safe. And now there's this need for extreme mediation between people and God. And so I'm going to skip a lot. I'm going to skip all the way to Exodus. I'm skipping over Noah and a bunch of other important things. But for the sake of time, the Exodus, which is really the beginning of the nation of Israel, God reintroduces Himself to the people again through Moses and through the Exodus. He frees them from slavery. He invites them into a covenant relationship with Himself, which is an ancient legal agreement, basically. They would obey His law, worship Him alone, and He would be their God, protecting them and leading them to a new land. Israel's calling was to be a holy nation of priests, set apart by God in order to bless all the other nations. So this was never, God's finished plan was never to just have His favorite nation and save them. He was using the nation of Israel as a nation of priests to show the rest of the world who He was, to be a blessing to all the nations. This is in the covenant that He establishes with Abraham in the very beginning, when Abraham is looking at the stars and saying, your descendants will be like the stars, in order to be a blessing to the entire world. So through Israel, God's plan is to reintroduce Himself to humanity again and draw all people back to Himself, essentially restoring what is lost in Genesis 3. But through Israel's history, God's presence is not a safe place. Still, even when He takes the initiative and moves radically towards his people and draws them towards himself, his presence is not safe. He goes with them from place to place in the wilderness, in the tabernacle, and eventually in the temple in Jerusalem. He makes his dwelling place there with his people. But how approachable is he, really? The image of the Exodus wandering in the desert is holiness and danger go together. He's a pillar of flame. He's a pillar of smoke. You don't approach him. Only Moses goes up. And Moses is the chosen one to sort of mediate between God and the people. You see an aspect of this association with holiness and danger in Isaiah 6. This is obviously skipping way ahead, but it's an important passage, and we'll sort of go back in a minute. Isaiah 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord, high and exalted, seated on the throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were called to one another, and they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried, "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am. Send me." Unbelievable what is encapsulated in this short passage. The holiness of God is not a safe place to be for someone who has unclean lips, right? He's aware of the massive gap between God's holiness and his sin. His vision of God brings him fear. His sin, another way of saying it, his sin is a liability in the presence of God. And yet, God is, and this happens right after the seraphim say, "Holy, holy, holy." It's the holiness of God, which is terrifying to him. And yet, God is willing to make atonement so that Isaiah can stand in his presence and not crumple. And then receive his calling and accept his calling. And so this image of a coal being this purifying heat from the altar being touched to his lips, which he knows are unclean, this enables him to stand before the living God and then to, in a sense, receive his orders. And which is really, it's one of the many Old Testament prefigurings of the atonement of Christ. Your sin is atoned for. Now you can stand in my presence. So, through the establishment of the sacrificial system, I'll deal with this very inadequately. It's quite complicated, and I don't have a full grasp of it. But through the sacrificial system, God offers people a mediated way back into his presence, a limited way back into his presence. But their sin has to be atoned for through sacrifices. And there is obviously a cost to this hospitality. Something dies. As the book of Hebrews says in chapter 9, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. So that's kind of the context in the Old Testament through that hospitality can take place between God and us. There are many different kinds of sacrifices, some of them for a specific sin against God, some of them were fellowship offerings or thank offerings, but most would involve burning part of the animal and allowing the smoke to rise to God. And there's this language of God receiving a pleasing aroma, essentially. The obedience of the worshiper as they burn part of this sacrifice is a pleasing aroma to God. And in the case of a fellowship offering, the worshiper would eat a portion of the animal in the presence of God. So they don't burn the whole thing. There's burnt offerings where they burn the whole animal, which is this a very sort of the most dramatic sign of obedience to God. You give the whole thing to him. But then there's the fellowship offering, which some of it is burned, and then you, the worshiper, eat it in God's presence as a tangible sign of this peace between you and God. And so to eat in God's presence is a profound theological thing that God welcomes Israel to do. Something you can only do if you feel safe. And God offers the invitation, taste and see that I'm good. Eat in my presence. There's now peace between us. But an Israelite would have to make sacrifices again and again and again. And again, it's a mediated hospitality. It's mediated through the priests, through the physical layout of the temple, some parts of which you could not enter, and through sacrifices. And so God remains, in a sense, shrouded to a degree. There's a distance still there. One observation is the invitation has changed. In the beginning, the invitation was be fruitful and multiply. There's no implication of distance or alienation there at all. But now, to receive God's hospitality, we must respond to a different kind of invitation, and that is an invitation that people are free to reject. It is the invitation, come back to me again by entering into a covenant relationship with me, by obeying my law and accepting your need for atonement. So this is it's a complicated thing, right? It's fraught with difficulty, and there's some painful self-realization that has to happen to say yes to this invitation. By the end of the Old Testament, it's not actually clear what will happen. Israel has broken the covenant relationship with God again and again by worshiping idols. They've failed to be God's holy nation. They have, in large part, rejected their call to bless other nations, and they prefer to view themselves as God's favorites and to try to pray down his destruction on every other nation. Will God's people ever experience the presence of God again? What will happen? What is he to do with him? is the necessary question to ask at the end of the Old Testament. What's going to happen here? He's made a lot of promises, but they have not kept their side of the covenant, have they? And so we're going to move now to the big heading of redemption. In Jesus Christ, we see the resolution of this tension between God's holiness and his role as judge, and then his love and his mercy. How is he going to find a way to embrace both of those aspects of his own character? In Jesus, I think we see the hospitality of God revealed. One of the things that Jesus reveals is that God's hospitality is not a passive thing. It is a pursuing hospitality, or a rescue mission hospitality. In modern terms, if you're a parent and you have teenage kids, I don't have teenage kids yet. Someday I hope to have teenage kids. it's not just, I left the door unlocked for you, honey, you know, or I left the light on in the hallway. Or it's not just, you know, if you're ever in trouble, I'm here for you. Come and find me if you're ever in trouble. That's not the image of God's hospitality. No, his children are lost, and he's going out into the dark to find them. So this is the act of pursuing character of God's hospitality to us. God became a man in order to bring us back to himself, because he knew that there's no way we could have done that. We wouldn't have come back to the unlocked door. Jesus' teaching is rich with images of God's hospitality. He picks up on the language of invitation that we see in the Old Testament, and he uses that language with authority. In other words, he makes the invitations himself. He's not just saying, my father says, come to him. He says, come to me. So he's making the invitation himself with the authority to do this. Who does he think he is, right, to speak like that? Think of all the words of invitation that Jesus speaks in the Gospels that only make sense if it's God talking. And I'll just read a few here. I'll just kind of barrage you with a list of examples. Probably many are coming to mind for you already. But in Matthew 11, starting in verse 28, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So he's claiming to be able to himself give us rest in our souls. Not something any of us can claim to do for anybody else, right? Luke 11, verse 9. So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Another invitation. In Matthew 19, verse 14. Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Later on, he says, unless you become like these, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. A more threatening thing to say. But Luke 14 is the parable of the banquet, and this is the master talking to his servants. Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, the servant said, what you have ordered has been done, but there's still room. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. That's a very assertive invitation. Go out there, find them, compel them, tell them to come. There's food. The table's set. Right? This is pursuing hospitality, not a passive hospitality. Luke 15, the entire prodigal son story. I'm not going to read it, but I'll just give a synopsis. When the son comes to himself and rehearses his apology and then eventually starts walking home, the father sees his lost son while he was still a long way off. That's a great phrase. I love that. It's worth reflecting on a lot. While he was still a long way off, the father saw him, which means the father was waiting and watching for his son. Right? And he runs to meet him. And he instantly, before the son is able to apologize fully and do his rehearsed kind of spiel, he reinstates him as the heir, or as one of the heirs of his household. He puts a ring on his finger. He begins preparations for a massive party. And then later on, once the party's in full swing, he begs the self-righteous older brother to come in and join the celebration too, because the older brother is loved as well. That brother might prefer self-exile. We never find out what he decides. But in any case, the father is entreating him to come in. So in short, there's this desire in the heart of God that Jesus is trying to show us, to shower us with extravagant, undeserved hospitality. You come home, I throw a huge party for you, no matter what you've done. Some of us, I think, are so concerned with respectability and balance in life and being good, nice-looking Christians, that God the Father, I think, appears a little imbalanced to us in this story. There's a wonderful theologian named Jeremy Begbie who referred to that. He said that in a lecture. You know, we're so obsessed with just, you know, order and looking nice and not expressing any emotion too strongly that God the Father looks a little crazy to us when we come to this. He's sprinting down the driveway. He's embracing his son. He orders preparations to be made. He is so eager to forgive and so enthusiastic to get us back. This is his response. He's watching. He sees us a long way off, and he sprints to meet us. And yet, this is the picture of God that Jesus would have us hold on to. The only reason Jesus can make all of these great-sounding invitations is that he knows what he's about to do for us, right? The invitations are basically renewals of God's hospitality, but they only hold hope for us because of the cross. Without the cross, none of these nice invitations hold any hope for us at all. He says it because he knows what he will do. Because sin was the barrier between us and God from the time of the fall on, sin has to be dealt with once and for all. So Jesus does this at the cross by suffering God's judgment for our sin and giving us in return his righteousness, his perfect standing before God. And theologians have referred to this as the Great Exchange. It's this amazing teaching in the Bible. The Great Exchange, meaning we give Christ our guilt, and he takes it on himself and suffers the punishment for that. And he gives us his moral perfection, or he gives us the quality of his relationship with his Father, essentially, which is what righteousness is. And we put that on. And so, when God looks at us, he sees the righteous life that Jesus lived. And when God looks at his son on the cross, he sees all of our folly and rebellion. God's holiness need never be a horror to us again because of the cross. Because of Christ, we are made holy, and the presence of God is no longer the terrifying place that it was. And one of the best visual aids in the Bible, it's not just a visual aid, I think it happens, but it's also a visual aid, is the temple curtain that tears from top to bottom when Jesus dies. It's a historical fact, but also an incredible metaphorical image for us to hold on to. As the body of Christ breaks, so does the barrier between the most holy place of God, where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, where the priest could only go once a year. So that barrier breaks between us and the holiest place of God. The guilt of sin is removed from the people. So, I might have skipped a few slides here, did I? No, Hebrews 4, verse 16 says, "Let us approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." The striking thing about this verse is that it is a throne of grace at all, and not a throne of judgment, right? We come before the throne of judgment, that's a different sort of thing. But the writer of Hebrews is saying it's a throne of grace that is available to us. Approach it. So, and the fact that we can approach it with confidence and not fear. An amazing claim. Because of his sacrifice, Jesus can make the greatest invitation of all, which he makes right before his death. We think of maybe the quintessential picture of what God's hospitality is when he says, "Take, eat, this is my body broken for you." So the institution of the Lord's Supper, which demands a lot more time than I'm giving it in this lecture. Just so you know, I agree that it deserves a lot more time than I'm giving it. But he says, "Take, eat, this is my body broken for you." It's become the central ritual practice of the Christian faith that he told us to do in remembrance of him. It's a reminder that we have no life at all apart from his sacrifice, his atoning sacrifice. He is our food and drink, as tangibly necessary to us as food and drink. And this is really it's what he's getting at earlier in the Gospel of John when he refers to himself as the true bread that came from heaven, in distinction from the manna that came from heaven that your ancestors ate and died. "I am the true bread that came from heaven. But you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood to live." And so that was a hard enough teaching. A lot of his followers left at that point. But the ones that continued following him grew to understand what that meant after the resurrection, I think. But anyway, there's something very strange about Jesus' way of offering God's hospitality to us. And I think there's two reversals going on here. In the prologue of John's Gospel, it says, "He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not know him, or did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." And the first reversal, I think, is this, that Jesus is the host, but he comes as a potential guest, knocking at his own door, asking people to receive him. He's humble enough to receive hospitality from people his whole life. As far as we know, he never owned a house. he's bumming off of people everywhere he goes. He's getting fed. He's getting put up. He's an itinerant preacher most of his ministry. He's humble enough to receive hospitality from other people, and humble enough to receive rejection from people too. As he says in his own words, "The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." So he comes asking for hospitality. And the question, of course, that's implied in John, in the first chapter of John is, who is going to welcome him? There's a distinction here. There's people that reject him and there's people that receive him. Will you offer hospitality to this stranger? Will you celebrate his coming? It's a good question to ask ourselves. It's a question that we sometimes think about at Christmas. We talk about the birth of Jesus. But it's a question to ask ourselves every day. Do I celebrate the coming of Jesus right now in my life? Am I hospitable to his presence? There's a wonderful there's a liturgical piece of music that we used to sing when we went to an Anglican church in Vancouver. And one of the refrains was, when he comes, who will make him welcome? And this is a good question to ask ourselves. The second reversal, so that's the first reversal. The host becomes a potential guest knocking at the door of his own world. The second reversal is this. Our decision whether or not to open the door to Jesus is really ends up being our decision whether to accept his hospitality. It's the same thing as our decision whether to enter the door he is opening to us. We are actually the ones knocking. We are actually the ones in desperate need of shelter. And to open the door to Christ is actually to walk through the door into God's love and acceptance forever. So to say come in to Jesus is essentially to hear the words come in from God. To say come in to Jesus is to hear the words come in from God. I read a review. I confess, this looks like a really interesting book that I found out about 2 days ago, and it's on the way to my house in the mail somewhere. It's by an Australian Catholic theologian named Brendan Byrne. But it's a book called The Hospitality of God, a reading of Luke's Gospel, and he's looking at the whole Gospel of Luke with the interpretive lens of hospitality. And this is just a snippet of the review of the book. I hope to read the real thing someday. Luke portrays the life and ministry of Jesus as a divine visitation to the world, seeking hospitality. The one who comes as visitor and guest becomes host and offers a hospitality in which the entire world can become truly human, be at home, and know salvation in the depths of our hearts. And a little bit later, those in Luke's gospel who readily offer hospitality, chiefly the marginalized and the poor, find themselves drawn into a much deeper sphere of hospitality, the hospitality of God. Those who have difficulty sharing are challenged by Jesus to conversion, so that they too may not be left out of the banquet of life to which God calls all human beings. Wonderful, concise kind of statement of what I'm trying to get at, this reversal. If you offer hospitality to Christ, then you're coming to the banquet, right? One story I think that illustrates this beautifully, there are many, but one of which is the story on the Emmaus Road after the resurrection of Jesus. So go read that on your own time. But the other one is the story of Zacchaeus. And it's interesting, Jesus receives hospitality from Zacchaeus. He invites himself to Zacchaeus' house, first of all. So it's kind of like... But nonetheless, Zacchaeus says, okay, come to my house. And Jesus enters Zacchaeus' home. And actually, by doing so, he is the famous visiting rabbi. And by inviting Zacchaeus to offer him hospitality, he's actually honoring Zacchaeus. There's probably many other people in Jericho who would have liked to have Jesus to lunch that day. But Jesus chooses Zacchaeus, who is obviously ashamed of his standing. He can't. He wants to see Jesus, but he's unable to approach Jesus exactly. He's in a tree. By welcoming Jesus into his home and offering hospitality to Jesus, actually, Jesus is offering hospitality to him. He realizes Jesus is the host by the end, and salvation comes to his house, in Jesus' words, today. And it's not just, yay, I'm going to be with God forever. It's accompanied by transformation. He decides to pay back all of the money he has swindled out of the poor people of Jericho by being a tax collector. So there's this amazing reversal again. You offer hospitality to Christ, but wherever Christ goes, he's the host and you're the guest. And so even if you're feeding him. And then there's this image of a final banquet. If we could sum up God's invitation to us in Christ, it would be something like this. Come to this massive feast. Abandon your pride, which is really the only obstacle to you coming. Accept your need and don't miss the party. You come on Christ's righteousness. That's the nature of this final invitation. We see an amazing prophetic picture of it given to us in Isaiah 25. It's a picture, I think, it's important to remember, of something that's only possible through the work of Christ in the distant future. So on this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day they will say, surely this is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. This is the Lord. We trusted in him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. So the entire feast is just an opportunity to rejoice at what God has done forever. And you think of the barriers that we talked about of sin, the ways in which God's holy presence is a danger to us, the way holiness and danger are go together throughout the Old Testament. Well, this is a picture of all of that being completely obliterated, right? This is a story both of a feast, enjoying not just sustenance, but the finest of wines and the finest of meat, and then all of these barriers that are taken away, the barrier of the fact that we will die, we will never die again, our sin, our disgrace, our tears, all gone. And this is the picture of the banquet that Jesus is really inviting us to through his sacrifice. And I want to just conclude. Why all of this background, biblical background? I've been trying to basically show us that it really is appropriate when the Bible tells us that all of us who are Christians should offer hospitality. It makes sense. And I've been stressing these two reasons. One, we're made in his image and he's hospitable. He is the host and we are like sub-hosts. We offer micro-hospitality. He offers macro-hospitality. We offer micro-hospitality with the small spaces that he's entrusted to us. We still have the dominion to offer those places, to open those places up to the stranger. And the other reason is really from our experience as fallen yet redeemed people. There was a time when we were all strangers and God took us in. And so hospitality is simply passing along a gift which has already been given to us in a much fuller sense, in a much deeper sense. And actually, I think that the truth is even more startling in the sense the bad news is worse and the good news is better. We weren't just strangers of God, we were enemies of God. That's what Paul talks about this in Romans. We were enemies of God, and we're not just enemies who've become guests or strangers that have become guests. We're enemies who've been adopted. So the good news is better than we sometimes remember also. It's not just invited into God's house for a meal and then sent on our way. It's a permanent hospitality signified by a legal adoption, basically, that does not go away. When we accept Christ, we are adopted into God's family. We are his children and heirs, co-heirs with Christ. So the move has been from enemy to beloved child. That's the ground we've covered. Through redemption in Christ. And this is our identity. And I'm trying to argue that if this is our identity, then it should really shape how we live and how we treat other image bearers of God who are outside our doors. Most of whom, honestly, are not our enemies. God called us to love our enemies, which is very, 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 very challenging. Maybe one of the most challenging things that Jesus says. But most of the people we would have into our houses are not our enemies, right? They're just strangers. Ephesians 2, he came and preached peace to you who were far away and peace to those who were near. For through him, we both have access to the Father by one Spirit. Consequently, we both have access to the Father by one Spirit. Consequently, you are no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people and also members of his household. I just want to do something that is potentially a little bit, we'll still have some time for discussion. I want to sing a song together, which I think expresses this message about God's hospitality beautifully. It's actually a setting of Psalm 23 that Isaac Watts wrote, and it's called My Shepherd Will Supply My Need. If it's an unfamiliar melody, that's just fine. Those of you who do know it, those of you who come to Monday morning prayer meetings on the Bree, sing out. You know who you are. And the words will be on the screen. And it's a beautiful setting, just poetically, of Psalm 23, but I think gets at exactly what we've been talking about today. And then after that, we will break into a discussion time. There will be a tea at 11? 10:45. Okay, so soon. But if anyone who wants to stay and keep on discussing can do so, but you can go out and get tea. And then it's 11:15, right, that the next event starts in here. Is that correct? Okay, so that'll be Sarah leading us in a workshop. But for now, let's... Thank you. So we have a few minutes to talk, like 4 minutes. Anybody who wants to forego the beginning of their tea time and keep chatting can, but feel free to drift out throughout the discussion and have a break. Yeah, anybody have questions or comments or objections? Or yes, yeah. Yeah. It's by Brendan Byrne. I think it's B-Y-R-N-E. And I wish I could recommend it with authority, but it looks very good. It's called The Hospitality of God, a reading of Luke's Gospel. Sarah.
Just an observation of connection that happened for me. In between the anxiety, the sweat of our brow,
yes,
that comes with the curse, and it just struck me, Jesus's promise, come to me, all you who are weary, like what a counterpoint that is, and
yes,
and a reversal, and so to see his invitation to rest. Am I doing the anxiety here? So I just appreciated that.
Yeah. And he gives, I don't think I gave the whole saying of Jesus, but it's, my burden is like my yoke. He's offering to take on a different burden and a different yoke, but he's offering it to people who are burdened and heavy laden. So it's a different type of thing going on here. There's a relief of that, but in following him, there is rest. Yeah, Marty.
And going up in rest is in the Matthew 5, do not.
Yeah.
For what
you're
looking for. Because you're having a father. The release of the seal. God's character is clothing people care. So again, there's the fallen anxiety doesn't control it.
Yeah.
Yes. Abigail. On anxiety, I saw a documentary called The Dark Matter of Love.
Okay.
Where they talk about a study that was done with monkeys and taking baby monkeys away from their parents. And one of the things that makes people courageous and without anxiety in the world is having a parent figure that they go to, and then they are free to explore it.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jesus, at the triumphal entry, he's going into Jerusalem. Instead of having an army or a tank or, you know, a giant nuclear missile on the heart, his power, the big gun, is a donkey that's never been ridden with his mom. And his mom is calming down the donkey. Just by being there, that the donkey is courageous enough to carry this guy up and help. And that is the big gun. And that is what gets rid of anxiety. It's our Father in heaven and his love.
Yeah. I think you see a demonstration of that also in the like you were saying, in the lives of the relationship between parents and children. I've done a little bit of reading on curiosity as a sort of a virtue, something that children have innately, but that can either get crushed and buried or encouraged. And one of the things that is really important developmentally for a child's curiosity is to have a place of security, parental security, essentially a place that is safe to venture forth from and explore, and then go back and know that they're safe, know that they're loved, and then go back and explore further and further.
And that's essentially what this documentary was about.
Yeah.
It was following some adopted kids who hadn't really had a bond of love, and how they struggled to relate to other people, how they struggled to relate to their own emotions, and how they had lost something.
And that is so sad. That one of the studies about curiosity found that children, some of the few children who do not exhibit the typical childlike curiosity, are children who are in war-torn places, and or refugees who do not experience any security. So curiosity sort of goes at that point, because there's no place of safety from which to venture out. Yeah. What's the name of that documentary again? Dark?
The Dark Matter of Love.
Dark Matter of Love. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
So question and an observation. So at the beginning you started off by talking about three characteristics of genuine hospitality, making room for the outsider and creating a space they can be themselves and offering something genuine of ourselves. Will that be four more later today?
I can't promise that my colleagues are going to pick up on those aspects, but it's something that we can definitely... they might, and we might talk about it more. Yes, okay, good. Sarah can stay with more. Yeah. And I'm very conscious a lot of things I said were quite abstract and needing some flesh and bones on it. Was needing some concrete examples. I was trying to fly over it from 30,000 feet. But yeah. Definitely. And there's caveats there that I haven't mentioned also about, you know, what does it mean to allow someone to fully be themselves in your house if they're a drug addict? Or, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that we need to talk about practically, but yeah, I think that will come up.
But, yeah. There's going to be more talk about it today.
Well, yeah. I don't know if you were here last night, but I brought up the question of how our larger church gatherings practice hospitality.
Yeah.
So I was interested in exploring the space of a church gathering as well as the space of a home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the observation I was going to make is that the lecture that Joshua brought us, as you mentioned, the other term, he referenced John Walton.
Mm-hmm.
And John Walton treats the beginning story of Genesis, he compares house building and homemaking. And he says, God built the house and he made the home. But his assertion and his exploration as a Bible scholar is that when we see Genesis, the beginning of Genesis, that's his homemaking story. And he elaborates the whole thing around the framework of establishing functionality.
Yeah.
He talks about the first 3 days as time, weather, and food.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, it's just interesting how that ties back in so tightly to hospitality.
Yeah. And I haven't read, I've read pieces of that book, I haven't read the whole thing, but I think that what you just said there, a different way of saying it is like it's just the hospitable space, the habitable space is homemaking. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
First of all, thank you. It was excellent. It was a great conversation for today. My question to you is a kind of practical one.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me you're a key to this, to offering hospitality in light of what God has done for us is to somehow have ways to continually remind ourselves that we were once strangers and enemies of God.
Yeah.
So what are the practical ways you do that or that can be done?
Hmm. Well, that's a great question. How to stay in that place of remembrance that this is who we were. What initially pops into my head is that actually it's sort of a feedback loop. As we open our homes to strangers, it can be a picture to us of our own alienation from God, which is now gone. And so certainly taking communion is one of the reminders. That is, you know, Jesus didn't tell us to do it for no good reason. The remembrance, remember me, remember what was necessary for you to come to God. I'm sure there's lots and lots of things. Telling the story to each other. That's why we read scripture. That's why we're supposed to interact with other believers who can remind us and tell us. I mean, Israel had this amazing series of sort of insurances set up to remember, right? You know, they the whole sort of calendar of festivals throughout the year, reenacting things that happened to them. Build this pile of stones here, so that when your children ask you what's that about, you tell them the story again. And so it's just, you know, there were people who were called to remember. Remember, don't forget. I am Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt. You know, if you forget that about your identity, then you're in trouble. You're going to worship other gods, and so yeah. I mean, I think that the broader call to remembrance, I think there's
It seems to be
so many different ways, yeah.
The heart of hospitality has to be that sincere.
Yeah.
To be reaching out to people who are at losses.
Yes.
You once were.
Yeah.
And are prone to be.
Yeah. Yes. One more, and then I'm gonna dismiss you all for some tea. And I'm okay if I have two more because you had your hand up there. You first, and then you. Sorry. Go ahead.
Love that you talked about the what people call the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
I like to call it forgiving father.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, the son was already part of the house.
Yeah.
He was already a son, and he'd gone afloat.
Right.
But that what God did for him was to lay it out completely.
Yeah.
And I thought about how that relates to people who are already Christians,
yeah,
who are lost or,
yeah,
feel condemned.
Yeah.
Or that we can lay it out like that,
mm-hmm,
that he did.
Yeah.
And of course the brother's not too pleased about that.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks, why didn't you do that for me?
Yeah.
It's such a great account to,
yeah,
remember that we, even though we are sons,
mm-hmm,
we can at any time get out in left field and,
yeah,
hog country.
We'll need it. Hog country, yeah. Adam hog country. I like that. But and we'll need, where we find ourselves, the wonderful language there is like he came to himself, basically.
I love that.
There's,
yeah,
this transformation where he just realized suddenly, wait a second, what am I doing?
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
And
I'm going
to
die.
The runs to
yeah,
him,
yeah.
As he said.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the you know, it's also good to remember that the whole parable is spoken to people who are self-righteous and think that they don't need the mercy of God. So really, the original listeners are the older brother character,
mm-hmm,
and that's the part that's left up in the air. You know, we don't know whether the older brother is going to come to himself or not. He's the one that's standing outside who's wondering, what in the world did all my hard work mean? You know, if this kid can come back, you know. Yeah.
So in light of hospitality and Jesus had no place. He had no home to welcome people into. And his hospitality was a hospitality of just daily meeting people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that even in our churches and our fellowships, we come across,
yeah,
people who we don't get saved with.
Mm-hmm.
We would consider them the possible enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the larger, more permeating message, is that we need to consider that we were enemies,
mm-hmm,
that we're no longer enemies, we're safe in Christ,
yeah,
to love those,
yeah,
who we would perceive to be our,
mm-hmm, so you see that the conflict between loving strangers and fearing them, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's it's our fear of strangers that is the main obstacle very often to what are they going to say? What are they going to do at my house?
Mm-hmm.
What are, you know? Mm-hmm. What am I going to say to them? We'll hear about that more later.
Yeah,
but,
not even,
yeah,
in your house.
Yeah, or
if,
yeah.
Yeah.
Some of us are so afraid of awkward conversations we won't even talk to somebody who we don't know because of the agony that will ensue. Right? That's sad, right?
Well,
yeah.
It is.
No, it is. It is. But that's something to pray for, the confidence that actually is ours, to not fear people.
Well, in that verse, Hebrews 4, notice that finding grace and receiving mercy,
mm-hmm,
those are both verbs. Those are,
yeah,
both affects we have to acquire.
Mm-hmm.
We have to take the will,
mm-hmm,
to receive the grace that's been offered. That,
mm-hmm,
is monumental.
Yeah. 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 Adam, sorry, last one.
I just said that I'm really late. I just want to plug next week's concert because we're singing this time.
Oh, are you really? Oh, awesome. So Adam is the music director at my church, the church that Nikki and I go to, and he and his wife are coming with a small ensemble to sing some shape note music to us and explain a little bit about what shape note singing is. And so come back Friday night. Thanks, that's perfect. Okay. Tea break.
Perfect place.
I'll collapse it. Yeah. 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 I told Greg you would at 10:45. I don't think it may not matter too much.
Okay.
We have some babies who are holding up the hill, so we can go through here. That's my wife just signed it. Depends what you mean. You're quite different, but
Does
that organization still doing things in Massachusetts? I'm
yes.
Okay.
But very minimal. Or like, you know, that they have ramps up going up. They have, you know, they have a system that, you know, people that are hard of hearing can, you know,
important things, but
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they